Welcome back to the Dunktown Basketball Podcast, Tuesday night edition. We are recording late at night. It is 10:44 p.m. on the West Coast right now because we just had a Twitter user complain that we weren't doing enough late night wrap-up podcasts and that we just quit after a week. But we would never do that, would we, Danny?
No, it feels like old times, except we had a lot of games tonight.
I will say this, though. Sometimes when, like, I think all of us media people are kind of guilty of this. It's just so hard to get rid of your anecdotal experiences that we sort of think that like two Twitter responses is basically just like the zeitgeist of everyone.
No, I don't think
I think like
funny that you do considering your legion of followers, but I wouldn't concern yourself with
well
that.
All right, so this is the thing that like I think people didn't realize, and this is not really basketball, but before I actually started on Twitter, I just assume that all these people with like 20,000 followers, they're just getting like so many replies all the time that like they just, you know, your chance of actually them seeing it is incredibly low. And especially if it's during like an off time, like during the day or something, like you have a pretty high chance of like me seeing your at reply if you send me something. Obviously, it's hard to respond to all of them, but usually I'll at least see it unless it's like during a game and I'm doing a bunch of tweets and then having to kind of watch the game. Then I usually don't have time to look at my replies unless it's like during a break or something. But you know, having a lot of Twitter followers is not like, I think you have to get up to like 200k before you're like not seeing every mention generally.
So what you're saying is Amin Alhassan is just ignoring all the jokes I sent him.
That's true. And by the way, if you haven't listened to yesterday's podcast with Amin Alhassan, you definitely should. That was a fun one that we did talking about some of the early season surprises and about 8 million other things, as always happens when he's on. But anyway, let's talk about the game of the night. And no, the game of the night was not Oklahoma City, Washington. It was Utah-Cleveland, who are two of the best teams in basketball so far.
They really are, and unlike the Oklahoma City-Washington game, which was kind of marred by injury during the game, this one's the injuries happened, well, actually there was one during it, but mostly they were before. So you got to kind of see these teams as they are right now.
Yeah, I thought that this was a really interesting strategic matchup in a lot of respects because Utah is kind of a little bit of a different team, and obviously the Cavs are too with LeBron. But, you know, Utah doesn't have a point guard that you really need to guard that much, although Burke has been playing better. So there's that aspect of it. You know, Utah also, despite being a really good defensive team, doesn't have that one awesome wing stopper unless they want to get all the way down to Elijah Millsap, who you know, isn't good enough offensively really to get much time. So it was interesting to see. And then also they have Hayward, and Cleveland really doesn't have their own wing stopper either. So it was very interesting to see what the machinations were with these teams matching up with one another.
And yeah, there were cross matches all over the board. We saw one that was been true throughout the season, or at least for stretches, with Cleveland actually putting their center, whoever that was, Mozgov, often on Derek Favors, and putting Love oftentimes on Rudy Gobert.
Yeah, and that was because Favors is a much better post-up guy. He struggles to post up against true centers, and when he was kind of the starting center playing along with Cantor, he wasn't nearly as effective offensively. I think that's actually an underrated aspect of getting rid of Cantor and starting Gobert along with Favors, is that he gets more time against power forwards, but now teams have kind of wised up and put their center on Favors anyway, because Favors, he's huge. He's like 270. When they actually went with Thompson on him, he was able to just like put Thompson in the goal. It was pretty impressive. Thompson, I've been lauding for his post defense recently, and going back to last year's playoffs, like, you know, Pau Gasol wasn't able to do much against him, for example, last year. But Favors just was much stronger than Thompson. He was able to kind of dominate him. So they had to go with Mozgov on Favors, and they even brought Mozgov back more in the fourth quarter than they have been. So what it fell to Gobert to do then is to try and dominate on the offensive glass against Love, and he actually had some success. I think he had three or four offensive rebounds. So Utah had a pretty good offensive game against what has been a good Cleveland defense so far, although obviously Cleveland won, and their fourth quarter offense, Utah couldn't stop them.
Yeah, and part of that was Rudy had an injury. I believe it was an ankle injury. Incidentally, there were two kind of incidents with Love and Gobert. Each one was kind of tangentially involved in the other one having a lower leg injury. But Gobert's was more serious, and he missed a lot of the fourth quarter, which helped. I think that helped give Cleveland the fuel for their run.
Yeah, it was interesting with Gobert. He obviously had turned his ankle. He then kind of went back in the tunnel, tried to run it off. They brought him back in, which I feel like is just not advisable when he's clearly limping the way that he was, especially with a guy who's 7'2". I think he's had a broken foot in his past. I can't remember which foot it was. But you just never want to mess around with those kind of foot ankle injuries. And, you know, I would imagine that he'll probably miss a couple of games. That's usually what seems to happen on those sorts of things. And he did get one alley-oop once he came back in, but he was scared to come back down on that left foot. And I think maybe that's what then led to the trainers taking him out, or maybe he just couldn't move and it was a performance thing. So that was a little discouraging, but, you know, nothing we haven't seen from many a team. And, you know, Love injured his ankle and he stayed in as well and seemed to be fine, was able to finish the game.
Do we want to save my photographer rant for another day or go on it now?
No, we've both made it before. I think basically what we'd like to do, and if anyone wants to help us out on Twitter, I certainly would appreciate the endeavor, is to just, let's just count all the guys who injure themselves, or, you know, if not injure, at least like tweak something, come up limping as a result of the cameras. And Love didn't make contact directly with the camera, but he definitely tried to stop himself in an awkward manner because he was surprised to see the camera in there, and that's why he rolled his left ankle.
This game also had another one of my injury-related bugaboos, in that J.R. Smith snuck up behind, was it Gordon Hayward? He snuck up behind somebody.
No, it was Burks.
It was Burks, and
you're talking about that sorry charge at midcourt.
Yes. And
or it wasn't a charge, actually it was a travel.
But you know, I think they should try to legislate that out. You know, it's just,
yeah, I mean, you should just never be able to draw a charge until you've crossed half court. Like, it's just, there's no legitimate reason for you to be jumping in front of someone and trying to fall down in the back court. Like, it's just, it's not a basketball play. It should be out of the game. You know, we all hit that. Let's not get too derailed, yeah, though, here, because this was a great game.
It was.
And I'll kind of just go through a few of my notes here. LeBron was 10 of 11 within 8 feet in this game, and he was 1 for 8 on jump shots, and yet the Jazz weren't really able to keep him out of the paint. They were still going over pretty much every screen involving him. And LeBron, other than that Indiana game, just has not been hitting the jump shot all year. He's even at 60% on free throws coming into tonight, which is also pretty bad. So I still worry about his jump shot, and my philosophy every game pretty much would be the Greg Popovich from the 2013 finals plan. Just make him prove that he can hit a jump shot. We're going under every single screen.
I agree, and it was, I think Gordon Hayward did a decent job of kind of letting him shoot, but then once they put Rodney Hood on there, I believe it was because Hayward was in foul trouble, he made two kind of egregious LeBron-related mistakes. But the first one, the more notable one in many ways, was he bid on a LeBron three-point pump fake, and then that got him 3 free throws, and even though he's at 60%, that's still a whole heck of a lot better than him shooting a three-pointer.
Yeah, that's true. And then the other one was he fouled LeBron. And he just wasn't prepared for how strong.
Exactly.
It wasn't
a bad foul.
He tried
against
to
anyone
wrap
else.
Him up. Yeah, I'm sure that. And I mean, you get to the point with LeBron, too, where if you foul him any harder, then you're risking a flagrant as well. And also, I mean, almost like a dirty play of injuring LeBron. I don't think that guys need to do that, especially in a regular season game. But, you know, LeBron still was able to get to the rim. I mean, the fact that he was able to take 11 shots within 8 feet, even when his jumper is not falling, is pretty impressive. That, in some respects, is a testament to the amount of shooting that he has around him now that Love is back, I think. And also, I think Cleveland, their offense generally looks a lot better than it did last year.
It does, and I think part of that's that they're incorporating Love a lot more, and it helps a lot when Mo Williams is hitting every shot in existence.
Yeah, that's true. What was he, 8 out of 9, like 29 points? I mean, that was just completely insane shooting, and it's not like, I mean, a couple of times, like Hood lost him a couple of times, Burks lost him a couple of times, but most of those shots were pretty tough shots that you just got to kind of live with, and he was just making them.
Yeah, and
it was all jumpers with him, too. It wasn't like he was like getting to the basket. That's not what he does.
Yeah, he wasn't doing that, and something I was thinking about during this game was, you know, there were a couple moments where it just felt like that was their choice. Sometimes it was Dellavedova, sometimes it was Mo Williams. It was like, if you have to leave a seam, that's the guy to leave. And then I was thinking about, well, when they're full strength, that's Kyrie Irving, so that seam is going to be somewhere else.
Yeah, that's true, and it'll be interesting to see if they can keep up this ball movement once Irving returns, since he is a guy who kind of likes to pound the ball a little bit. But really, just the side-to-side ball movement has been very solid for Cleveland. They're just getting more system buckets. Richard Jefferson is a very good cutter. He's able to get a couple of buckets every game, cutting to the basket. Love, too, will he's very good when you get a switch on him of trying to duck in and getting really good post position, which is, you know, what guys mess up a lot of times. And he's just intelligent. He'll kind of catch a guy napping and then get his butt into him and either pick up a foul or be able to get a deep post up. So he does well when they do switch the pick and roll oftentimes with him and LeBron. I like what Cleveland's been doing with more ball movement, more player movement. And we'll see if that's something that continues throughout the year when Kyrie comes back, when the going kind of gets tough.
What do you think of Trey Burke and Alec Burks? I don't know why, I guess because their names are similar, but I think with the way that they're playing together, I think they look good overall tonight.
Burks is a guy who has always had great physical gifts. I mean, as a two-guard, getting off the dribble, his explosiveness, ability to finish at the rim, change of direction, acceleration, all that is elite for the two-guard position. And now he's starting to get to where he's actually hitting his three-pointers off the dribble as well this year. That's been really a boon for his game. I mean, I think kind of the next step for him is going to be really making some of the more advanced reads on the pick and roll, which he's kind of doesn't necessarily do yet. You know, he's not finding guys on the weak side, that sort of thing. But a lot of times the Jazz are able to get him the ball on the move on a dribble handoff after reversing it, so that's not as much of an issue where you have to kind of read a set defense. And, you know, once he turns the corner, he's able to finish over guys at the rim. And I thought Burke has played well too. I mean, he's shooting over 50% now on threes. I kind of wonder what's going on now with the Jazz point guard position. I mean, they basically have three options. Neto, who's been starting and essentially just not coming back any plays, like 6 minutes. He only played 4 minutes in the second half. And then they'll bring in Burke for a while, and then they'll either kind of go back to like the triple wing offense. I think they've been closing games most of the time with that, with Burks, Hood, and Hayward at the wing positions and no point guard. What do you like the best of those three arrangements?
It depends a little bit on the opponent, but when you can make it work offensively, I think I like the triple wing the best. Burks can defend ones well enough. I actually really like that, and it gives him a size advantage, which I think he can use really well. But Trey has played a lot better. I think that those are the two. I haven't been super impressed with Neto so far. He's fine. You know, he's a guy that I think can be a part of a rotation, but I don't think you want him closing games.
He brings some things. His defense is better than anticipated. You know, he's got a real nice anticipation for steals. He generally doesn't screw up. But yeah, the fact that he can't, and he's a good passer, but the fact that he can't hit a jump shot at all is definitely a problem. And, you know, he may be one of these guys who kind of, you know, ends up being like a good RPM guy, even though he doesn't have much in the way of stats in the end. But I really think it's time to kind of go with the two best lineups, which is maybe you start Burke if you don't want to start that triple wing, which I understand. But then if you're going to close with that, you know, maybe you bring Neto in. Maybe the thought is, though, that they have enough scoring with Favors, with Hood, and with Hayward in the starting lineup, that you can get by with Neto, and that's the time to do it, as opposed to the second unit where you're going to struggle for scoring. You need Burke. So I understand that thinking too, but I just think ultimately Neto should be kind of giving way to Burke as well as Burke has been playing, even though he ultimately kind of ended up getting a couple shots blocked and turning it over in that big Cavs 21-5 run and getting taken out at the end.
Yeah, that's true. One other thing I wanted to mention when we're talking about kind of Utah's rotation players, I was critical of Trey Lyles before the draft. I've never been a believer in his jump shot, but he drilled an above the break three in this game, and it floored me a little bit. I mean, he had looked better in the preseason, but just to see him do it in a big game like this was...
Yeah, it looked really smooth, too. I was impressed by that. Now, they have not been playing well when he's been on the floor. He is like in the red by like 30 points already. In plus minus this year. He's the only guy on the team who's like that. And obviously plus minus is noisy, but when you're the only guy on the team, you start to worry a little bit about that. And I think that kind of gets to a little bit more of a philosophical question from Utah with their backup units. They actually have one of those good problems, which is they have probably more wings than they even can use on this team. And most teams don't even have, you know, two good wings on their whole roster, not to mention enough to really successfully go small. I think more teams would like to go small. Utah, I think I might like to see them do more of that now on the second unit. I mean, I think that they've struggled to find a fourth big. It's been with the Tibor Pleiss, despite being 26, 27. The noise about him being ready apparently is incorrect. And Trevor Booker is okay, but, you know, not so. And he can have some moments where he'll will you to a win with his energy. But if he's kind of not playing that way, he's not a guy who I think, you know, has to get automatic minutes in a game. So with that being the case, maybe you just go more with guys like Ingles. I mean, you could maybe even try to get someone like Elijah Millsap a little bit of time, you know, for 2-3 minutes a game if the other team has, like, some awesome wing scorer. And just mix and match those wing guys instead of going to Lyles and Booker together as backup bigs for, you know, 3-4 minutes a half.
It won't solve all their problems, but something I'd like to see them do is play Millsap against a good player, kind of like how I'd like to see Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, except that he's starting now, and then give Hood a little bit of time with the second unit, because I think he can be an offensive anchor for them, which would be nice for them, especially if they're going to move Burke into the starting lineup or do, you know, play Burke with the starters more. I think that stagger would do nicely for them, but I mean, one of their issues is that they don't have a rim protector in the second unit that they can trust, and Favors and Gobert play so well together that I don't think you want to stagger them. I think that it's not worth giving that up to do that.
Yeah, I think it depends who the other team has on their second unit as well, because Favors is really so much better as a backup center than anyone else that they could bring out there. And if the other team has a guy who's not really a true center as a backup, then I really like Favors coming in and getting some post-ups against the other team's second unit. Now, I mean, we shouldn't overstate these problems. I think this Utah team is going to be real good. I think they're well coached. You know, this is not meant as like some criticism, just things to kind of try. And I think even at the point guard position, Quinn is at the point right now where he's just kind of trying to figure out what he has with everyone. He has a lot of options, and they're playing well overall. So I don't think that there's like some desperate need for a change, you know, in the way that we've talked about with some of these other teams and their rotations and who they're playing, Pistons. But yeah. It's. I think this Utah team is good. I feel good about them still after this game. I would have too bad that Gobert ended up getting injured and we didn't get to see both teams at full strength down the stretch.
Yeah, I like Utah a lot. I think that, like I thought with the Pistons last night, and we'll talk about that a little later, I think that they'll be a good regular season team because their size and their energy and their defensive ability is something that will catch a lot of teams off guard, and it's hard to adjust to in a one-off format. And I think they're a playoff team. I mean, obviously, there's a lot that needs to come into play. I mean, hopefully Rudy's injury isn't severe and things like that. But that was something you brought up during the game is, you know, what seed people think they're going to end up with. And what I said was 6, because I think the top 5 teams in the West, barring, you know, something catastrophic, I think those 5 are pretty clear. And to me, in terms of regular season success, they are the most durable. And I don't want to say they're the highest ceiling, but I think they're the team that will withstand what a season brings the most.
Yeah, just because they do have so many pieces. And it's interesting, you and I were both critical of them in the off season that they didn't just use that cap space that basically is, you know, they're not going to really have it. I mean, they'll have it, but it's not going to buy them as much next year as it would have this year. But on the other hand, I mean, especially when you consider that they thought they had Exum, I mean, this team has a lot of weapons and a lot of guys that they can go to who are good. I mean, Joe Ingles, we probably weren't even still thinking of as that much of a rotation guy, and he's having a wonderful season. So, yeah, I like to see if you had to predict right now, what seed do they get in the West?
I think it's 6. I think they're...
So they're going to be ahead of Memphis and then New Orleans with their rough start, although they went tonight. You got them ahead of them?
I think so. I could... I'm not firm on that. It's not like, oh, my God, if they get the 6, I'm going to be... If they don't get the 6, I'm going to be floored. But I think right now, what's concerned me about Memphis is just... that there are some games where it just seems like they don't have it. And that is a problem, because if there are games that you're just not going to win, to get up to the high 40s is not – I'm not saying it's impossible. It's just harder – it's a harder sell for me than what Utah's done. Like, a game like this, Utah lost, but they were in it the entire time. You know, if Rudy hadn't gotten hurt, it was – and this was against one of the 5 best teams in the league so far at their house where they've been a good home team. So – To me, that is a win that makes me more confident in them rather than less.
Yeah, I think so. I'm not ready to give up on Memphis quite yet.
Agreed.
I still think that, and they had a nice game against the Clippers last night that they almost won. At the Clippers, that's a good performance. That is what you would expect out of a good team to play the Clippers close at home. And they also, we've seen this from them before as well. They kind of started in this malaise. They did that in the first year under Dave Yeager in 2013-14. They were like 500 through 15 games, and then Gasol got injured, and then they just roared back at the end of the year. So I'm not, and they're not in that deep of a hole record wise. You know, it's not like they started 1-7, even though the differential has been pretty rough. So I think that there's a decent chance that they get in. But yeah, I would say Utah is probably the favorite for the sixth seed. What do you think the chances are they get into the top five?
Ooh, that's hard. I mean, I think all those teams are so good. I'd say, let's say 1-3. I think that's about fair.
Yeah, especially when you consider the fact that one of those teams could end up suffering for some injuries as well. So a couple other notes here that are just a little bit more random that I'll go through that I had in the game I thought were interesting. Utah was really ready for the skip passes that Cleveland likes to throw, and they, I think, forced like 10 turnovers in the first half, a lot of them intercepting them. So Quinn really had them coached up for that. Another play that they did real well on was the 1-3 side pick and roll, where they actually, and this is what shows the incredible versatility of Gobert at 7-2, where what they were able to do, they'd run the side pick and roll, LeBron would sort of go to the corner, and the guys guarding at the point of attack did a good job of forcing kind of a lob pass to LeBron, or if they would switch it as well and had a point guard on LeBron, they would force the lob pass, and then Gobert was able to get over there while the ball was in the air, trap LeBron. They forced a turnover as he tried to throw a skip pass, and he threw it completely over Love's head. But Rudy Gobert able to get out there and trap hard 22 feet from the basket in a place that's very hard to throw a pass from, with the only guy being open directly across court. That is really fantastic strategy and fantastic execution by Utah. Then it turned out, though, that they were not able to stop the 1-3 pick and roll up high in the fourth quarter. What they were doing was LeBron would go to set the screen, and then he would slip it and go to the left elbow, catch the ball on the move, and then that's how he was able to get right to the rim quite a few times.
Yeah, it was a nice little kind of way to handle what they were doing. But I was impressed, as you were, with Rudy in this game. I think that why I've been touting him for Defensive Player of the Year as a possibility is that I think he's a lot more versatile defensively than people give him credit for. And also, he made a couple of really nice passes in this game too.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, I think he and Favors had like 9 assists combined, which is excellent for them, as Jazz broadcaster and friend of the program David Locke noted. A couple other notes. We have not seen much of LeBron in the post so far this year, which was basically all they did in the playoffs last year, was him kind of ISO post up. So we haven't seen that. He hasn't really been that effective in the post with his jump shot, but he also is kind of, I mean, I think he's in a little bit more chill mode. That can wear you down to just have to bully guys down every single time. Let's see, what else did we have? I think that's about it on this game. But yeah, it was a really good game, very high quality game. I enjoyed it, and I'm looking forward to seeing a lot more of Utah this year. I think at some point in the future we'll do like a fan power rankings, where just what teams we would most want to be a fan of for the next 5 years, and I would put Utah like pretty high up on that list, I think.
Yeah, they would definitely be high up on that.
All right, so before we move on, let me tell you about our sponsor, SeatGeek. And now that NBA season is in full swing, if you want to get NBA tickets, which I'm sure our national audience definitely does, SeatGeek is the cheapest and easiest way to do that. They aggregate hundreds of ticket buying sites, so you can be sure that you are getting a look at every ticket that's reasonably available. You don't have to go to all these different sites and freak out, oh no, like, do I have to go to another one? There might be a better deal out there. You know, it's the same way as when you had to go to all these different airline sites, then there was Kayak. SeatGeek is the same thing, except SeatGeek's even easier because it's an app on your phone. You don't have to bother with all those prove you're not a robot, CAPTCHA, inscrutable letters that you then have to hit the button and get it to play it, and then it still doesn't make a human word, so you still don't know what it means. All those things are out the window with SeatGeek. It's just an app on your phone. Once you get signed up, it takes less than a minute to download. It's one click. You can look at this tool they have called Deal Score that tells you whether it's a good deal or a bad deal. So you can just have easy security, know that you're getting the cheapest price, and also you can get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase via the code CAPSPACE, which is something we talk about a lot on the program that lets you know that they came from us, gets them to keep sponsoring us, gets you to keep being able to listen to our show. So everybody wins if you go to SeatGeek. All right, what we got next? This Washington, Oklahoma City, which will appear next to the definition of the word anticlimax in the dictionary.
I was going to say buzzkill, but yeah, pretty much the same.
So I wanted to, we talked about Anthony Robertson, and this is actually, he actually had a good game, so it's kind of unfair that we're bringing this up, but I wanted to, anyway, we talked about how there are guys with Robertson sort of being the poster child who, where your offense will have an advantage, the ball gets swung to them, and then just nothing happens. Either they won't take the shot, the defense is just allowed to recover, they're not able to widen the opening or take advantage, and you're just kind of back to square one, and now someone else has to go get the ball and create an opening. So we're kind of soliciting names for what those guys should be called. And Ethan Strauss, of course, because he is incredibly literate and funny, came up with calling it a record scratch, basically, where you're running the offense, everything's humming, you know, you're having a great party at home, everyone's talking, and then someone walks into the room and just like the record scratches and everything stops. So record scratch guy, we can call that for Robertson, who, yeah, had a great game and didn't actually earn that title in this game.
Yeah, but and it ties in with something that is important, and we talked about it in the playoffs with Drew Gooden, which is that at a certain point, there's a separation between what a guy can do and what a team thinks a guy can do, and so there might be a lag on this, even if he ends up doing better than we thought, that he'll be a perceived record scratch, and maybe it could even turn to the point where that Oklahoma City could use that to their advantage.
There were so the only problem with that, though, is that his own teammates still see him as that guy,
right,
too. Even though, I think he's 5 of 12 on threes this year and over 8 games or whatever they've played, and the number of that's still not enough attempts from him. He still passes up shots, but he definitely is like getting more confident, because there are some hilarious times in this game where he was just like so incredibly ready, like hands ready. No, my hands are really ready. Like, and then Westbrook just completely looked him off and drove into traffic. One time he actually scored, the other time he turned it over, I think, but it was pretty funny. So we'll see. He still has got to speed up his release. I mean, it's not even the accuracy so much as it is the fact that he can get them off and get the volume up that's really going to be important for him. And I think if he can do that, maybe they still won't play him over Waiters down the stretch, so it doesn't matter.
We should also get to the reason this game was a buzzkill, and that was because Kevin Durant hurt his hamstring after a drive in the first half.
Well, no, I was going to say, the game was pretty much over by that point. They're already up by like 17 points.
That's true.
I think the biggest reason was because Beal was out,
yeah.
Nene was out, and Nene hasn't even been playing that well. We've made the observation that even when healthy, Washington might only have like 4 decent players, and really you would think of Beal and Wall as their only really above average starter. I think Gortat and Porter are kind of average guys, and so they just didn't have enough good guys. I mean, it was Humphreys, it was Gooden, it was DeJuan Blair getting minutes. Kelly Oubre came in. I mean, he hit a couple of threes, but you know, he's not at the point where he can execute the system very well. Jared Dudley still is not really quite into the type of shape I think he would like to be in. Garrett Temple was getting minutes. I mean, these are just guys who are not good enough to beat good teams with, and they got smashed, I think, as a result of that. It was just, there was a time when Wall was just getting them all sorts of open threes in the first half, and they were 3 out of 14 on threes, and Oklahoma City was 8 out of 9 on threes. So maybe the carnage wasn't as bad because Oklahoma City was just on fire from three, and they couldn't hit any even though they were open. But they sure looked outclassed in this game overall.
It sure would be great if they had somebody who could kind of push everybody down the rotation and also hit a lot of open shots.
Yeah, a couple other observations on this game, because it was kind of a blowout. I turned away from it in the second half. Marcin Gortat is probably the biggest practitioner of this shot in the league. And I don't mean to single him out, because this is a shot that is kind of the holy grail for post guys when you're learning how to post up. The fact that you can shoot an offhand jump hook is sort of like, all right, these are your bona fides as being a skilled post player. But And having a good offhand is incredibly important, and I always rag on guys who don't have it, but that's around the rim. Once you get like 4 or 5 feet away from the basket, pretty much any shot with your offhand is a bad shot, even if it's a hook shot, even if you work on it. It's, you know, and Gortat takes like some of these from like outside the lane on the left block, like right on the baseline, and that's just not a good shot. I think that's just something that Roy Hibbert is another practitioner of that shot. Back when they used to throw him the ball in Indiana, now they never give it to him anymore, but in L.A. So it's time for guys to just kind of acknowledge that that is a shot that's going to go in 35% of the time at best.
Yeah, I think it's an issue that's definitely frustrating. And was this one of the first times you've really gotten to see Otto Porter this year?
No, I've seen him plenty, and I saw him plenty in the preseason too.
Right.
He is... definitely has the length. You know, I wouldn't say he's an above average athlete for a small forward, and he's usually there, but he doesn't somehow have the ability whether to just challenge shots very well against some of the star small forwards in the league. I mean, Carmelo lit him up in the preseason. Carmelo lit him up again for 37 about a week ago when the Knicks won at Washington. The Knicks now have wins at Washington and at Toronto, Durant obviously just had his way in the first half. So I'm not sure that Porter is really a guy who, despite the fact that he was drafted this way and seems like he would be, is someone that you can think about as a guy who is an above average defensive stopper on the wing. I think he's better with his length kind of helping out and from the weak side and stuff, and he gets some steals. But one-on-one, he's not a guy that I feel incredibly confident against star small forwards on the other team.
Every once in a while I get the feeling with him, obviously he won't have this opportunity considering who they have on roster, that he might be better defending twos than threes.
Yeah, I could see that because then he can kind of use his length, back off. But I don't know. Maybe that's not true. I mean, Beal obviously is going to defend twos, and I think he can do a good job of that at times. He's talked about improving his defense. He missed the game, by the way, with a bruised shoulder. That's kind of a day-to-day thing. It shouldn't linger. Although I will say that my Washington has a 20% chance of getting the number one seed in the East, but I'm going to pick them anyway because one of those teams, other than the Cavs, is going to be it. Number one, it looks like it's going to be the Cavs. They're playing great, even with all the injury issues they have, and I wrote about that today for the Cauldron. And number two, Washington does not look like anywhere close to the best of those kind of also-ran teams' knees.
I don't need to comment on that.
Who did you pick to get the number one seed?
Was Miami, Cleveland, sorry. Cleveland, yeah.
Yeah.
You remember choice. I picked LeBron to win the MVP, and part of that was I thought they were going to start strong without Kyrie. I thought their schedule was soft early in the year. And, I mean, to win a game like this, I thought this was one of the tougher games on their early schedule, and they beat Utah, you know, not soundly, but cleanly.
Yeah, and they could get the narrative going, although Curry has gotten, would clearly be the front runner now. And, you know, we'll see. I mean, he's kind of come back down to earth these last 3-4 games. Not that the team necessarily has. I mean, they have a little bit, but not that much. So it'll be interesting to see if he continues just sort of playing, you know, about like he did last year, which he's been these last few games, how long those first 3 or 4 games kind of holds. Because we've talked about before, just in people's conceptions, that when things happen right at the start of the year, they tend to linger in perception much more than, you know, a 2-week stretch during the middle of the year.
And they were all on national TV, and if this team has if the Warriors have the best record in the league, then I think that the narrative is pretty easy for him. The other huge part that basically everybody other than Anthony Davis has is that the Pelicans have started so weakly that I think it's going to be tough for Davis to be really seriously in that conversation, though Blake Griffin, I think, has really supplanted him in that part of the conversation.
Durant, he pulled his left hamstring as he went up off his left foot on a drive trying to score over Gortat. He was actually stayed in the game until halftime and then was taken out. Again, doesn't look like it's something too serious. I don't think he's going to have an MRI, I read. So we'll see. I mean, he'll probably miss a couple of games. Muscle injuries are obviously the type of thing that can linger, especially a hamstring or a calf. But I wouldn't expect him to miss a ton of time. But, you know, it could be a couple of games maybe, and we'll see what happens. All right, anything else on this game, or should we move on here?
We move on. Where do you want to go?
Well, I didn't watch this Miami Lakers game because I've seen a lot of both teams lately. I figured it was time to focus on some other teams. But more controversy, Kobe missed the game, and still D'Angelo Russell only played 21 minutes. Huertas came in at the end. Scott, and you kind of were following what people were saying out of there a little more. Do you want to explain it?
Sure. So one of the benefits of the Lakers is that they have a great media group and they ask good questions, and Byron Scott chooses to answer those questions. And so basically the Heat were – it was a close-ish game. Russell was pulled when the Lakers actually, I believe, led by three. And then,
yeah, and let's be clear, by the way, he was terrible in this game, at least by the box score, right? Like,
I was watching other games as well, but it's, you know.
Yeah, I mean, negative 20 in 21 minutes, 2-for-6, 4 assists, 2 turnovers. So, I don't know if he was terrible, but he wasn't really doing anything.
He was negative 20 at a point when they were ahead, so it's not like they were getting killed at that point. And so Scott pulls him, and then he never comes back in the game, and Byron Scott said after the game that part of the reason why he didn't come back in is that Miami had too big a lead.
Yeah, and some people were speculating that Scott is trying to teach him a lesson. He had that hilarious quote that the wood has a way of talking to your butt, talking about the bench. I don't think that NBA benches are made of wood anymore. We've kind of moved past it. Maybe they were in Scott's day. Actually, they weren't still, but nonetheless, a hilarious quote. But yeah, I don't know. So Russell got asked about it after the game. What did he say?
He said, I'll give the exact quotes because it's so much more fun. I got to figure out what I'm doing wrong so I can correct it. Then somebody asked if Coach Scott explained what the issue was, and he said no, and that he'd have to see for himself.
Well, I mean, granted, I don't think that if someone doesn't play down the end of a game, I think it's not normal for a coach to have a discussion with them about why not. I mean, I think most of the times that's the case anyway.
Right.
But especially in between the end of the game and when the guy is talking to the media, like that's, I don't think Scott is like somehow remiss in like not telling him. And, you know, if they go through film session tomorrow and he says, here's all the mistakes you made, this is why I took you out. Like, yeah, I mean, I think that's totally sufficient. So I don't think that in itself is an indictment. One thing I was thinking of, though, is maybe it would behoove the Lakers, once they're clearly out of it, which should be any day now, apparently, maybe they try to trade Lou Williams to open up another $7 million in cap space this upcoming summer. He's got another 2 years on his contract at $7 million per after this. And I think there's a lot of teams that could really use him. We saw one of them last night.
Yeah, Detroit is definitely a team, especially with Jody Meeks being out such a long time, that could do that. And why I think you and I both really liked the Lou Williams contract was that we saw it as an immediate asset. You know, it was one of those contracts that it was reasonable. And so while people like to think of contracts, even in the modern NBA, as, you know, you're signing that guy because you want him, if they can do that and get something that makes more sense for them in the long term, I fully support it.
Yeah. Lou is a little bit of a tough fit, and I think this is part of why he was not brought back in Toronto, because he's not a good defender. He's got to play the two. You know, he's not really going to be playing at the one at all. So that means that you're also probably, your backup point guard is not some amazing defender. And if your backup point guard is a good defender, then he probably can't shoot at all. So now you're basically forcing yourself to play on the second unit with two small guards, and Lou can be a really efficient scorer. But he is not the easiest guy to fit a second unit around necessarily, other than the fact that he can score, which is nice. But I think you gotta, if you're really on a good team, you gotta kind of be judicious about how you deploy him. But that said, you know, if he's coming in for like Steve Blake or something, it's a lot easier to just do that. So let's segue now. I mean, we were at the Detroit Golden State game yesterday. You know, we know what Golden State is, but I thought it was really instructive seeing Detroit in person, and they impressed me. How did you feel about them?
I think we have to start with Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. He is what we talked about it a lot last night, so it's going to feel like we're rehashing it that we didn't talk about on the podcast. It was just the two of us talking. Is that his combination of athleticism and length is awesome against Stephen Curry.
Yeah, it was interesting. He did by far the best job that anyone's done on Steph. Steph missed a bunch of shots on Friday against Sacramento, but they were wide open. Sacramento wasn't doing anything to cause that. It was just Steph missing. In this game, every time Steph came off a screen, called off the ball. Caldwell Pope was there. He even was able to help off his stuff a little bit and close out. It just, his speed is fantastic. And it's not only speed as well in a straight line, but it's also your ability to get up to full speed and then break down and stop really quickly. And that's something that he was awesome at. Because when you're chasing a guy around a screen, if you get behind a little bit, you have to accelerate. But then, you know, especially with Steph, you could either he'll do the flyby on you or just curl around the screen or something like that. And Caldwell Pope just did a great job of still just breaking down and being there when Steph caught the ball. I couldn't have been more impressed by him. And I think Detroit overall is just a team that's going to have, now that Stan Van Gundy has really had a chance to employ his vision and also to coach these guys up a little bit for a year or two, this team is going to be a problem on defense for a long, long time.
They are, and they have a lot of talented players. I mean, you think about that. I think Stanley Johnson's doing well. I was impressed with him again tonight. I like him. I don't think I'm as high on him as you are. That isn't a criticism. I just think you're a little bit higher on him than I am. But Marcus Morris is playing really well with their first unit. His issue is not like other guys where he's being buried or anything like that. He's just getting Marcus Morris is doing a great job. And really, right now, they only have two holes in their rotation.
I think backup two, you would have to point to also. I think they really have three.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Well, yeah, I mean, after Joe.
Because Meeks is out, yeah. And Reggie Bullock, someone corrected me that it is, in fact, Bullock instead of Bullock, is not someone that Stan really appears to trust.
That's true.
But yeah, I mean, with Stanley Johnson has great hands defensively and is incredibly strong. KCP is great in the passing lanes. Reggie Jackson has some length, although he's not really a great individual defender. Drummond is probably one of the best guys at getting steals that we've seen at the center position. He's excellent at that. He's incredibly quick. I mean, they just have some sharks on this team. And now, of course, when you talk about the Golden State aspect of it, they did something that most teams have not been doing. What most teams have been doing against Golden State is putting their best wing defender on Clay, trying to just take him out of the game completely, and then putting a point guard on Steph, and then Steph has been kind of killing him, right? Like, I mean, we saw that with the Rockets last year in the playoffs, for example, right? We didn't see hardly any Trevor Ariza on Curry. It was all Trevor Ariza on Clay, and Detroit decided, now we're going to go with KCP, see if we can shut him down, but then Clay went off for 24 points, and he also said now that he's feeling much better after suffering from a back injury for the first couple of games that he thought he actually should have sat out for. So that'll be interesting to see with Curry just so incandescent, whether we see more teams go with their best wing defender on Curry and whether that allows Clay to kind of start getting back to where he was at the start of last year, because he really was not nearly as good after the All-Star break and obviously those first couple games this year.
Yeah, and it was another, I feel like we can't talk about the Warriors without mentioning that, and it was another strong performance by Draymond Green. I mean, he's such a good player. And what he brings, not only defensively, I mean, he's going to be a defensive player of the year candidate again, is his intelligence and his ability to pass the ball from the power forward position allows...
He's leading the team in assists now, right?
Allows the team, because the Warriors... Barnes and Clay have strengths as players, but they're not particularly, I don't think of them as great ball movers, and they're especially not great at creating for other people. And so,
yeah, Clay has gotten better at least at making that quick pass along the perimeter this year so far, but generally you're right. I mean, especially making a decision on the drive, neither of those guys are.
Yeah, like if you close out on Clay and then he has to take a couple dribbles and what he's supposed to do then is pass it to somebody else, that's not his biggest strength. I'm not saying he's terrible at it. It's just not a strength of his game. And so Draymond, I think he gives them the buffer to make that palatable. And I mean, obviously those guys, and their defense is incredible, but I think Draymond is underrated as like the guy who makes this team work other than Stephen Curry.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's hard to say he's underrated anymore. He was number 19 in NBA rank this year, which is crazy. But and in this game, too, one thing that he was doing that both highlighted his strength and Detroit's weaknesses is he was able to keep Drummond off the offensive glass. And we've talked about, I think, on previous programs why it's such a problem, because he'll roll down the lane. The center has to go and help on Reggie Jackson on that 1-5 pick and roll, and then Drummond has a free run to the offensive glass. And so Green was guarding Ilyasova a lot of the time, and so he was able to actually get his butt in front of Drummond and box him out on that play, and once Reggie Jackson got pretty deep, and then Jackson was not able to find Ilyasova on the weak side or on kind of the kick back out pass. That's something that he really needs to work on. And Stan was asked after the game what he thought about how Ilyasova was playing. He's like, look, he's a guy who's going to thrive off of ball movement. He's going to hit open shots, but we have to get our ball movement better. And I think that those sorts of plays in particular are what he might have been referring to.
Yeah. Anything else you want to say in this game, or you want to move on?
No, I mean, I really enjoyed Detroit. Yeah. Drummond is just also has gotten to be a fantastic shot blocker. He had a bunch of guys shook. He even like made Steph miss a few layups. Azili, he was totally in Azili's head on a bunch of plays as well. Although I thought Azili did okay on him defensively, but he is getting to the point now where he's going to be a big problem for guys trying to finish in the lane. And you know, in his fourth year with the physical gifts he have, I think he's kind of. He's right on schedule. We didn't know for sure if he was ever going to get it. Some guys like, you know, JaVale McGee or Sam Dallenberg have great gifts and never get to that point defensively, but Drummond has now, and obviously being coached by Stan Van Gundy is a big help in that regard.
Also, his post-ups are a consistently amusing experience, whether they are amazing or something other than that.
yeah, that's right. So a couple of the other games in today, the Knicks-Toronto game was an excellent game that I didn't get to see all of. It was kind of my secondary game for a lot of the time because I was watching that Oklahoma City-Washington game and Utah-Cleveland. But I did see the end of it. Lance Thomas really came through for the Knicks. He was someone that I kind of derided them even bringing him back at slightly above the minimum. But he's been able to hit some three-pointers. He's even like made a few real NBA plays off the dribble now. And he's very versatile defensively. He's probably the closest thing that they have to a perimeter stopper, and so is therefore a good fit with Carmelo. Lance actually closed over Porzingis, I think, for that reason, because otherwise, with the way Toronto was going small, they had DeRozan at the three, so you couldn't have Carmelo guarding DeMar DeRozan. So they had to go with Thomas, and Thomas delivered in this game.
We should also talk about Langston Galloway. Langston had a big game. He was 2 of 3 again from three. He's been nailing three-pointers this year.
Yeah, he's like going into the game, it was like 65% true shooting. I think I read that he was like leading the league in three-point percentage. Too bad he doesn't start for this team.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's something that's been a dynamic with this team is that their bench has been doing so well. But I think the reason their bench has been doing well is because their backup guards should be their starters.
Yeah, Calderon was a little bit better in this game, and he's not as bad as Vucic is, and I think that he's someone who, at least with his shooting compared to Grant, you can construct, and it's not like their defense has really been that bad, even with Calderon in there. I mean, that's been one of the most pleasant surprises for this Knicks team. I just didn't think they were going to be able to stop anybody at all, and they absolutely have. And the, you know, part of that's because Porzingis has been better than expected, Thomas has been getting minutes. You've had Galloway has been excellent. Grant has been okay, even as a rookie. You know, Robin Lopez has helped to shore things up, and O'Quinn and Serafin have also been good. So, really, they, other than Carmelo, Calderon, and Vujicic, they don't have any guys who are just terrible defensively. And I thought those guys are playing a lot better, a lot of them, than I thought they would, or getting more minutes and being able to stay on the floor offensively.
Anything you saw with Toronto in this game?
Without Damari Carroll, they're in big trouble. Because they, at least last year, without Carroll, they had the offense. They could go to guys like Vasquez and Lou Williams and kind of try to get into a shootout with teams. But now they're starting James Johnson at the three. Johnson hit 1 3, but he's still not a guy. He's going to be a prove it to us guy on three-pointers for a long time. I think his best position is as a small ball four, and they played him that way some down the end of the game. But with him, Scola, Valanciunas, DeRozan, none of those guys are really plush. Scola's a pretty good mid-range guy. He's hit a couple of corner threes, but still not a guy who's going to a pure spacer type of guy. So really, Lowry is the only guy in this team who's really you would think of as a plus three-point shooter. And then when he has the ball in his hands, there's just nowhere to go for anybody. Valanciunas' post-ups, there's not a lot of space. So just having that guy, Carroll, who can both defend at the three. James Johnson is probably like a little bit too spacey defensively to be a stopper on someone like Carmelo, who had some moments in this game, even though he finished 10 out of 23. Ultimately, I mean, he had a pretty great run I think it was in the fourth quarter, but maybe it was the third, actually. I don't recall. But, yeah, I think they just missed Carroll so much. We haven't heard anything about when he'll be back from the plantar fasciitis. It's probably going to either – he's either going to have to sit for like a month or it's going to bother him all year. Neither of those is particularly palatable. So, yeah, Toronto now has lost three straight, but I think that's not a surprise because they just really, really need Carroll. They need that 3D guy. And then Ross is out also. He actually has some sort of a thumb ligament injury, which is not particularly encouraging either.
Anything else on this game, or was it? Did you want to move on to something else?
Did you see any of it, or should I just keep talking?
I didn't see any of this one. I know there was a controversial call late with Carmelo Anthony.
Yeah, he got trapped when I think the Knicks were up two, and he ended up both traveling and stepping out of bounds at the same time when he was triple teamed right along the sideline. Ed Malloy basically acknowledged in comments to a pool reporter after the game that he missed the call. He'd seen it on the monitor, but you can only review an out of bounds if it is called out of bounds. If it's never called out of bounds, you can't review it. And so they just didn't see it. Poor Dwayne Casey was yelling for a travel. And then also it was like right in front of him. He was like literally pointing to Carmelo's foot as it was out of bounds. And they just didn't get the call. Toronto also made a couple of attempts to come back here. And, of course, went for the quick two, but with the balls in DeMar DeRozan's hands, it was neither quick nor a two. He got fouled and only made one out of two. So that, again, we've talked, you know, going back to last year's playoffs about the fallacy of the quick two is a lot of times it's not quick. And, you know, it's still really, at best, you know, probably like a 50% proposition. You know, if you have a guy wide open for a layup, I think that most of the plays in that situation should at least have an option to just throw it to a guy literally wide open under the basket, make the defense respect it. But you generally should be going for a three if you're down three or down four, and you're not going to have a chance to get the ball back without fouling, because the odds are that a lot of times you're just never going to get the ball back with a chance to tie if you just have to play the foul game and keep doing the quick two thing.
There was a bad quick two at the end of Cavs Jazz too.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, at least that was a dunk by Burks.
And then they botched the coverage on the way back down, and Cleveland got it and won actually with Tristan Thompson.
Yeah, but I mean, the problem though with the quick two is like you figure, oh yeah, I'll just be able to drive in. They're going to concede it. That's not really the case. And once you've already decided to drive in and go for the two, if it's not there, then you're like, all right, am I going to force up a tough shot? Now I have to throw it back out, and maybe we'll go for the three or try to get another two, and now time's a wasting. You're better off just making the primary option always to go for a three. And then if they just so overcommit on the three and you can just get a clearly wide open two right under the basket, then you go for that. But just getting a three is always better. It's just we've talked about this before where the idea that coaches want to kind of stay in contact, prolong the game, you'll hear that a lot from color announcers. Well, the point of the game is not to pretend to be fouling and trying as long as you can. It's to actually win the game. And so they don't want to go for the three, because if you miss the three and the other team gets the rebound, the game is over. But fine. So what? Like, the point is to win the game. And if you make that three, then you're right back in it. If you make the two, you're really, you know, still a substantial underdog.
And the other huge point here is difference between the NBA and college or high school is that if you're relying basically on the other team making a mistake, that's a lot less likely to happen again with professional players that have professional teams that have more ball handlers, so it's harder to trap them and things like that. You know, those strategies rely a lot on turnovers, and that's not a high yield thing in the NBA.
Well, and it especially kills me when you're down four or two, because at least if you're down three and you get a two, then you know, even if they make both free throws, you'll still have a chance to tie with a three. Although, I also think going for the three earlier before they are going to intentionally foul you and prevent you from getting a three off is also important. That's the other flaw in that strategy, is that a lot of times you're going to be down under 10 seconds going for that three, and then your attempt can be obviated by fouling. But yeah, anyway, I've written about this before. We've talked about it before, probably going on too long. But, you know, we haven't talked about it in 6 months, so it felt like repeating. We got a lot of new listeners. Yeah, all right, that's about all I had on this. I guess the last thing I would say, DeMar DeRozan had 29 points in this game, and I have to say he's getting up there as kind of one of my least favorite players in the league at this point.
He's frustrating. I've alluded to it before, not as much on this podcast, about how I think that some team is going to get baited into trading for him before the deadline, and they're going to really regret it.
Yeah, I mean, he was 11 of 23, and then 7 of 9 on free throw attempts, and he had 2 assists in this game. He just does not pass the ball, and he was negative 10. He was the worst on the Raptors in 38 minutes. And now, granted, as we talked about, the spacing on this team is pretty rough right now. I mean, they bring in Corey Joseph, too. Bismack Biyombo, another guy who can't shoot outside of half a foot. Patrick Patterson has really been struggling. Corey Joseph is not going to shoot a standstill three unless he's got an hour to get it off and a gun to his head. So, yeah, it's definitely really hard for them without Carroll. He's like the absolute glue that's making this team go, and it's not a surprise that as soon as he's gone out, they basically have lost 3 straight.
It is. You want to move on to Boston-Milwaukee?
Yeah, let's just give a little bit on this one. RJ Hunter has been really impressive so far. You really liked him. I thought he was going to be pretty good, too. All the statistical translations loved him. I mean, this is one of the things, right, where, you know, there are definitely some guys who are statistically translated, at least in the publicly available stuff, very well, and then they don't turn out, right? But overall, most of these guys, and, you know, you could see a lot of great stuff from Hunter on film. I don't mean to discount that. Most of these guys who translate really well end up being steals. They really do. And Hunter's looking like another one of those guys. He's just an incredibly smart player. He's gotten defense much better than you would have thought. I mean, his shooting hasn't come around quite yet, but he's still been, you know, looked like a plus shooter enough to draw attention. And he's going to be a good player.
And what was remarkable about his, like, you think about his line tonight, I was a guy who was high on him. I nearly put him in my top 10 last year. That's how high I was on him. I decided against it at the end, but people know how well that top 10 is turning out. That wasn't a slight on any of those guys. But tonight, he had 7 points. He had 7 rebounds. I think he's an underrated passer. He didn't end up having any assists. And what he's showing is that he can contribute on a successful team in a lot of different ways, and that's what you want from a player who is a role player for now, who maybe can project into something more later on.
Yeah, this was kind of a weird game, and we've been killing David Lee a lot in this program. He actually, I thought, was pretty decent in this game, although now looking at the box score, he actually was only plus 2 in a game that they won pretty substantially. But he was able to make some plays. He was able to at least do the things that he's supposed to be able to do. You know, like playmaking, had some nice passes when he would catch the ball in a short roll and find a guy on the weak side. He actually even set a screen, even though, like, I think Amin, he was one of the guys Amin and I were killing on the program yesterday. And although he has kind of, we'll say charitably, bulked up a little bit, he's playing mostly center defensively now, and against a guy like Greg Monroe, he's actually able to hold his own a little bit more than he was in past years. Now, when you have a team that has spacing and has penetration, and he has to deter guys at the rim, he's not going to be able to do that. But the Bucks weren't able to really get that done in this game. And overall, it was a very comfortable win for the Celtics.
David Lee's strength defensively has always been man-to-man post defense. I mean, he had a couple of decent games, I think it was on Dwight. Like, he just had, like, that's the thing he could do. He can't stop penetrators. He can't, you know.
Yeah, I don't know if I would call it his strength. I think, like, he definitely got destroyed by Blake Griffin, for example, in that 2014 playoffs.
Right.
But I guess everything's relative,
exactly,
right, to his other defensive skills.
I was being generous. You know, like, I've spent 7 years making fun of David Lee, so I was going to be nice to him for once, and you're not even going to let me have that.
Well, I was nice to him already, but you got to be realistic, I feel right?
When I said it was a strength, I meant the word relative was in bold highlighted behind it. But that's what was fun for me kind of about this game is that the part I watched most intently, because it happened during halftime of other games, was the very beginning when the Bucks actually looked really good. And the Bucks, what they have that is such a huge advantage is they have so much length, what I call it is a thicket. And the reason for that is that sometimes it's really hard to get passes through because there's just so much body in between it and they're so active. And so there were a couple plays where Isaiah Thomas was justifiably trying to pass the ball into Sullinger or Amir Johnson or whoever, and the ball was just not making it through. And sometimes it was going back to Isaiah and he was trying it again. Sometimes it would lead to a turnover and the Bucks would run the other way. And that's an effect that a lot of teams just can't match because they don't have what Milwaukee has. The problem is they don't have enough of the other strengths, particularly offensively, to fully maximize what they can do on that end.
Yeah, and I think Giannis has been shooting more threes, which is encouraging just a little bit. He still was not as aggressive as I'd like to see him be. He was being guarded by the four-man a lot of times, guys like Olynyk, Amir Johnson, and those guys were kind of closing out to him in the corner, and he wasn't taking the shot that was open and then wasn't able to drive by them either. I still think that's something that he really needs to improve on a lot. He also had four turnovers in this game, not really one of his best games. And Chris Middleton is continuing to struggle from the field. He's shooting the three okay, over 40%, but he's actually, he must be shooting like, you know, low 30s on twos because he's at 38% overall, and he was actually 46% overall last year. So he has been asked to create, I think, a little bit more. That's what's leading to that. Jabari is starting to ramp up a little bit, but he's mostly been working as a finisher so far. He was 4-6 today. He had a couple of nice dunks, but transferring some of that load ultimately from Middleton to Jabari is going to help a lot. And also, they still have Carter Williams out. Tyler Ennis is someone who doesn't offer a ton, and they also kind of have some of these bench guys, like O'Brien was like negative 24 in 13 minutes. Damian Inglis got 12 minutes. I think he might be like negative 40 or something now in the season. Those two guys, and especially playing them together, not necessarily going to work very well for the Bucks.
Yeah, they need to figure out what they want to do with the front court, because I think we like the trio of Monroe, Parker, and John Henson. But if you're going to do that, then you need to play them as kind of a rotation, because you can't sub two of them at the same time. And so they'll just need to piece all that together or find other guys that they trust. But I like a lot of the guys just on this team in general. I think they just need to get the mix right.
All right, quickly, Dallas, New Orleans. New Orleans, I didn't watch any of this game. New Orleans got back in the ledger. Anthony Davis, right hip contusion. I don't know whether he actually came back in the game after that, but another kind of one of these little small nagging injuries that we completely trust the New Orleans training staff to heal. But, you know, just this could be, yeah, maybe he misses a game, maybe he misses a couple. You know, he kind of has a lot of these throughout the year, so that's something to monitor. Let's get to a little bit more on the injury news quickly. Rubio and Wiggins both missed the game against Charlotte, which was a Minnesota loss after that great win they had against the Hawks last night. Both of them had sore knees. We don't know much else about that. We mentioned the Ross thumb ligament, and also Gerald Green is suspended for 2 games by the team. So it's not a league suspension, which would be for substance abuse or crime committed or something. That's the league is the only one that's allowed to do that. This is for conduct detrimental to the team. We still don't know exactly what it was that he did, but it seems like we're not going to get that much more out of it. It was just kind of odd circumstances, I guess.
Do you want to go from that to the other big Miami news of the day?
There actually was one other small thing. Cuban was talking about, because I guess is Clippers Dallas tomorrow?
I believe it is, yes.
In Dallas? Yeah, he says he still has all of DeAndre Jordan's text messages. Someone joked that he should have just cyber-dusted with him instead, and then Cuban wouldn't have him. And why doesn't Cuban just let this go? How does it benefit him or the Dallas Mavericks to be carping about this all the time?
What's beyond me is that Cuban is somebody who I give a lot of credit to for making the perception of Dallas as a destination, and that they've done so much to make it a place that players want to play and they have good facilities and all that. And all of this after the fact has turned what would be a largely sympathetic story into one where there is no winner.
Well, I'll tell you what, the number one thing that you don't want to do on a date with a first date with a woman is talk about how your ex-girlfriend screwed you over, right? Like, so if you're basically your whole existence, your whole plan is getting free agents, do you really want to just say, like, now if you don't come here, like, this is how I'm going to treat you? Granted, like, DeAndre did them wrong, whatever, but it was big news at the time. It's time to just get over it. Pretend to be gracious, because taking this tack just makes you look bad for future people who want to come there. It, not only does it make you look like you're all bitter, but it just reminds people constantly that, oh yeah, this organization wasn't actually good enough ultimately for DeAndre to want to go to.
And it's especially not useful when the other team is more successful than you are. And so it's not like, look how good we're doing without them.
Yeah, right. There's no spite to it. Like, oh yeah, and they lost to him by 20 the last time with like nobody that they even brought with them. They didn't even bring most of their team with them in that game, the last game that they played, and he was still crowing about it. I just don't really get it. But yeah, let's talk about this trade, and I think we'll leave the like ultra cap minutia to the end. But just from a basketball sense, it's Chalmers and James Ennis for Jarnell Stokes and Beno Udrich. What do you think of it just from a basketball sense?
I think Beno is probably the better player right now. I mean, they have different strengths, but I like that...
Yeah, Beno is older. He's 33, yeah. and Chalmers is 29.
And he's less athletic, but he has a great mid-range game. I think he has a better kind of sense of the offense. He takes less risks. His turnover rate is a lot lower. And I think that that's a nice thing to have for Miami. Obviously, we've talked about that it would be nice, you know, if they have more floor stretchers because they have guys like Wade that don't exactly do that anymore. But I like that fit. And if we're not going to, I won't get into the finances too much yet, but he's a lot cheaper and that does matter.
Yeah. Yeah. We can talk about that in a second. From a basketball standpoint, you know, my initial reaction was, yeah, isn't Udrich better than Chalmers is at this point? And maybe that's not true. It depends on kind of what your team needs are. And Chalmers is younger. There had been whispers, too, that they weren't happy with the type of shape that Udrich was in. But Udrich was a guy who at least could create some offense. He's a guy who shoots really well on mid-rangers out of the pick and roll. Chalmers, not really a guy who's going to create in the pick and roll. He's basically sort of a 6'2", 6'3", guy who's just going to take standstill threes, essentially, or try and play off of others. And on that Memphis second unit, I think you really need someone who can run pick and roll, especially because you're running the center as Brandon Wright, a guy who's, you know, best in pick and roll. And so having someone who at least can be a little bit of a threat there helps. So I think offensively, it's kind of a step back. I mean, Chalmers is probably a better standstill shooter and definitely a better defender than Udrich, although Chalmers, you know, is kind of more of a steals guy necessarily than, you know, just a good, solid positional guy. So I don't know. It's interesting to see how he's going to be used. Chalmers is a better fit playing next to Mike Conley, but you know, I don't think he's better than Courtney Lee is for significant minutes there. So I don't know. I mean, I guess he's going to be the main backup point guard there. The only other one they have is Russ Smith, who, you know, I don't think they think is ready, and I don't think is ready, especially as a guy who can distribute. He's more of sort of a two-guard in a one-guard's body. So, yeah, I'm not quite sure I understand it from Memphis's perspective, especially since they're taking on more salary here and kind of doing Miami a solid.
And taking away a little bit of their flexibility because they're getting – now they're towing pretty close to the luxury tax, and I don't think they're ready to pay it. And so now they're a little over $2 million away from it. And so not only did they do Miami a huge favor without getting an asset really in return, especially not a long-term one, unless you see – Ennis is a better player than Jarnell Stokes, which I'm not sure that I do.
All right, so this will be our last segment here. We're going to get into some real cap dorkery. Woo! About how this trade occurred. If that stuff is boring to you, you can feel free to turn the program off. So the way the trade rules work for when you're at under $9.8 million being traded is you can take back up to 150% of the salary that you send out. And or up to 125% if you're in the tax. Miami is in the tax. That doesn't apply to them, though, because they're taking back less. So the relevant number is 150% of what Memphis is sending out. Udrich makes $2.17 million. Stokes makes $845,000. That's a total of $3.01 million. Chalmers is $4.3 million. James Ennis makes that same second-year minimum, $845,000. So that's a total of $5.145 million that Memphis is getting back. That is more than 150% of the $3 million that they are sending out. So how do they do that? Well, the answer is it's actually structured as two separate trades. So, and for each side, you can structure it at however you want to, you know, as long as it works for both sides, but they don't have to structure it the same way. So what, from Memphis's perspective, it's basically, or from both perspectives, actually, it's two separate trades. It's Udrich and Stokes, $3.01 million, for Chalmers alone, $4.3 million. That works. If you're sending out Chalmers, you have to, at $4.3 million, you have to get over $2.86 million. So they did that. That part of the trade is legal. But what about Ennis? He then fits into a trade exception that Memphis had because they traded away John Luer, who's basically making close to the minimum. And so they're able to just take on his salary without taking anything back. Now, people who really know a lot about this stuff might say, well, Ennis is making the minimum. Can't they just take him into the minimum salary exception? Basically, you can always trade for a guy who's making the minimum salary. Well, Ennis is making the minimum salary, but that minimum salary exception only applies both if you're signing a guy and if you're trading a guy, or picking up a guy off waivers for that matter, if he has a two-year contract or less. And so Ennis is actually on a three-year contract. That's why the Memphis trade exception had to be used to absorb him rather than just the minimum exception. So that's how you get to a legal trade with these guys. And it would appear, though, that the biggest motivation here for Miami, because I actually think that Chalmers probably helps them more than Udrich does, was financial.
Well, yeah, and the bigger motivation, I think you could say either way, if it's close, the financial part of this is huge because Miami saved about $7.9 million in the deal. And so that's salary, over $2 million in salary. And then because they're a repeater, that saves them a lot of luxury tax money. And so now they're only about $5.6 million over the luxury tax line, which, as Albert Namad, who we've talked about before on the podcast, talked about, that is a much...
Yeah, heathoops.com, by the way, is his site. He's got all this stuff and an even more hardcore breakdown than what we've just
said. So now they're in a place where conceptually, if they wanted to do a couple things, they could even potentially get all the way below the tax this year.
Yeah, to do that, they would have to dump Chris Anderson and then one other minimum contract as well. You know, probably it would be Stokes, I would imagine, because they actually like the rest, pretty much everyone
or,
else.
Or Benno, because there was talk about trying to find a third team.
Yeah. Yeah. Benno obviously would be another one. I don't think they really need him since they have Tyler Johnson now as a backup point guard. Although he could be at least
a depth piece. I like
some decent insurance. So yeah, and you know that's what the talk was, to get rid of more salary, and then kind of once you got rid of Udrich and you got rid of Stokes potentially, and I actually think Stokes has some modicum of potential, but. Once you got rid of those guys, then you could even take salary back for Anderson because you are basically, you know, there aren't that many teams that can just take on $5 million in salary, which is about what Anderson is making, without sending anything back. So you could get into a position where you could actually take something back for Anderson and still be able to get under the tax. And as you noted, they will be in the repeater tax this year since it will be... the third year, or they have been in the tax for three out of the last 4 years. So now, if they're in the tax for another year, it's the repeater, and that's $2.50 for the first $5 million over the tax per dollar, and then $2.75 per dollar for the next $5 million over the tax. So that's how you get to such significant savings, even from knocking $2 million off of your team salary.
Yeah. So basically, correct me if I'm wrong. If you want to think about the difference between the repeater, it's a dollar for every dollar.
Yeah. It's a dollar. Yeah. It's a dollar more for each gradation.
So that's you know, you could think about that even on $5 million. That's a lot of money, and you're getting it for that. And so yeah, it'll be compelling. The other storyline to watch with Miami in that is whether Portland is far enough below the salary floor. After, you know, when things get close to the end of the dance, when we get to the deadline, where it basically might not make much of a difference to them. And that might be the only real safe out that Miami has with that if they really want to shed a salary.
Yeah, and you would imagine that they would wait until the deadline because the tax amount is not calculated until the end of the season. They'll see whether Anderson really ends up being in the rotation as well. Stoudemire has kind of been out of the rotation, and they've been going, I think, now more small with Deng at the four. They've been playing McRoberts, Bosch, and Whiteside, and those are really the only bigs who have been getting a ton of minutes for them. So they may get to the point where they feel like Anderson is expendable down the end of the year. Pat Riley, somewhat comically, I thought, said that they would never make any trade just to save money or any move to... they would never trade anyone who could help them win a title for money reasons. So that's that leaves enough room for fibbing there. You know, if you're going to trade someone like Anderson. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how they get under. I mean, I think they probably will ultimately with the repeater tax, because then also if they don't get in it this year, then they're not in danger of getting back into it until like 2019, 2020 or so. And you know, it's going to be a much harder to get into the tax now with the cap going up so much. This is kind of the last year where I think a lot of teams are going to be right up against it, unless you're talking about Cleveland.
Well, and one other thing I want to mention with that, with the repeater, with them in particular, is we've talked a little bit before about Hassan Whiteside, and if they're going to sign him, they have to sign him using cap space, which makes it prohibitively unlikely that they would be a tax team next year. Because the amount, not only because the cap is going up so strongly, but if you need to use cap to sign one of your key players, that makes it very hard to push over, especially because they won't have functional, they won't have bird rights on guys like Dwayne Wade because his cap hold is so high. So they won't be over next year. So what this does is it pushes them out of repeater land for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, they will have bird rights on him, but they probably won't use them because they're going to be operating with cap space.
Exactly. That's what I mean.
Yeah. And his cap hold will basically, you know, be pretty close to the max. I think it will be the max, essentially. So yeah, all right, that's all I got on that. Anything to plug before we go?
Yeah, I recorded a podcast for Real Jam Radio with Audie Joseph that will go up tomorrow. I was editing it right before we started this.
All right, and I did a piece for The Cauldron about some predictions that might be wrong or might not be. You know, I sort of rated them, talked about my prediction that the Cavs would struggle, that the Hawks would struggle, Detroit might not be ready yet. You know, so I talked about those teams. Who else did I talk about? Was the Portland? Oh, yeah, Portland, yeah. I think was the other one, too. So those are sort of basically just wrote about those four surprise teams and kind of how they're doing it and whether we expect that to continue or not. So I enjoyed doing that one. If you want to support the show, we mentioned SeatGeek, obviously, using the cap space code. You can sign up for them. Same thing with DraftKings as well. Do some daily fantasy basketball. Entertain yourself there. And make some money too. An iTunes rating or review, that's been so helpful. Thank you so much to everyone who has been doing that. We really appreciate that. You could also like both of our Facebook pages, Danny LaRue NBA and Nate Duncan NBA. And all right, that's it.